Hey coach, if you've been waiting for the Confident Literacy Coach course to open up, your wait is almost over. The course is opening soon and I want you to be the first to know. Make sure you've signed up at confidentliteracycoach.com to be included on the wait list. You'll be notified as soon as it opens for enrollment. This year is going to be even better than before. I've updated the reading and writing modules to provide you with the knowledge you need to support your school in implementing practices that are proven to build skilled readers and writers. Get the PD you need to provide the PD and learning they need. Join the waitlist so you can join the course. Welcome to Instructional Coaching with Ms. B, where we believe that every teacher deserves a coach and every coach does too. I'm Chrissy Beltran, an elementary teacher who became a coach, and I had to create my own coaching program that worked. Now I teach coaches how to design their coaching programs, build a school-wide action plan, and use differentiated strategies to support teachers. Plus, I've got a special spot in my heart for literacy coaches. Now let's dig into the episode.
Coach, and welcome to episode 186 of Instructional Coaching with Ms. B. Today we are talking about culturally responsive teaching with Zaretta Hammond. I feel like Zaretta Hammond is practically a household name at this point, and she is so tied to culturally responsive teaching because she is so knowledgeable in this area. I'm really excited to talk to her because I think she's going to have some great information for us today. But before we get into it, I want to share a couple of important things with you. One, the Confident Literacy Coach in May is going to be amazing. I have got 6 modules for you that are full of resources that are going to help you coach reading and writing in classrooms at NPLC meetings. So if you want to join the waitlist, you can do that at confidentliteracycoach.com and you will get a coupon code for 15% off starting in May. So definitely join that waitlist because I want that for you. I know it's going to be supportive of you literacy coaches as you are trying to coach teachers in so many things and helping them make changes. Which brings me to my second point. My free webinar, Making the Shift, is available at buzzingwithmcb.com/shift. I want you to grab it. It is going to give you tips on how you can help teachers embrace new learning and actually apply it in their classroom. Because we've all spent way too much time giving professional development only to head to classrooms and see that no change has happened at all. So please check out buzzingwithmcb.com/shift. I made it just for you because I know it's what you need right now. And you can grab that, that webinar. Watch it, make the changes, and I know you're going to love it. Okay, so without further ado, we want to welcome Zaretta Hammond to the podcast. So I'm so excited to welcome you to the podcast, Zaretta. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Well, that's good because I am too. And to get to know you a little bit before we get started, I want to know a couple of things. I would love to learn about who you help and how you spend most of your time and energy at work.
Yeah, who do I help? It is a combination. So I have particularly a focus around instructional coaches. So those that are tasked with helping teachers in the classroom. When I have the opportunity, I certainly try to keep myself as close to the classroom. So I'm supporting teachers as well. But I also am talking to leaders. I just came back from doing a keynote for all the superintendents across Connecticut had gathered for their conference. So I'm in front of a lot of leaders talking to them about how do they support the work that should be happening in the instructional core. So those are my 3 core audiences that I support.
I love that because that is how we can make change happen sustainably at schools, is to have people empowered in those leadership positions that can support the change in the classroom over time. Change does take so much time.
It does.
So one fun question I want to know about is, what is a movie you could watch every day?
Oh, wow. And I am such a movie person. So I'll go 2 ways. So all things Marvel, I can watch the Captain America Winter Soldier anytime. Just put it on repeat. The other is Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
I particularly like Two Towers, although, you know, give me Return of the King, give me Lord of the Rings, extended version any day. Yeah. But that Two Towers, right? That is just, there's just perfection there.
I love that because, so my brother and I, youngest brother. I have 3 brothers. I'm the youngest one. Is 16 years younger than me. And we live in the same city. And every Saturday night, he comes over and we watch a movie. And every Saturday we would spend 20 minutes. What are we going to watch? What are we going to watch? You know, Finally, we said, we're going to watch series movies so we can decide once and let it ride forever. So we started watching Marvel back in 2020, and we watched all of the Marvel series. And our next series that we're going to watch after we finish Die Hard is Lord of the Rings. We're going to go back to Lord of the Rings. That's so funny.
Absolutely, because it's so good, right?
I'm so excited. He had to get new contacts, and so he had to wait until the new contacts came in to watch Lord of the Rings because he needed to see everything. Okay, so now to get into the stuff that is your area of expertise, can you please share a definition of culturally responsive teaching?
Yeah, I think, it's the kind of example, non-example, but culturally responsive teaching in its broadest sense, the way Dr. Gloria Latz and Billings talked about it, is really a pedagogy that is counter to the kind of inequitable kind of sorting that happens, in public schools from the beginning, right? So to counter that process, she talked about culturally responsive teaching. So building the right kind of relationships with students that allow the student and the teacher to have the kind of trust that teacher can focus on rebuilding and helping that student reclaim academic prowess. And along the way, she uses which she never called it brain science, right? But the understanding of schema and that the relevance of that content to the student was really about helping the student not just see themselves reflected, but to actually understand how the student had organized knowledge in their own head. I do think that's the important to talk about the non-example. So everybody's shaking the term culturally responsive teaching on everything, right? Just like gluten-free, like you go into a grocery store, meat, it's gluten-free. Well, it's always been gluten-free. What are you selling here? So very much like that, we see culturally responsive teaching. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it gets truncated to relationships, right? Or motivation. And so relevance, if you just show them something that comes from their cultural background as quote unquote relevant, then that's going to motivate the student to lean into learning. Now, we haven't even examined instruction, and that doesn't even, talk about whether that instruction is robust enough to get the student ready for rigor. And instead, it sells culturally responsive teaching as only about engagement or motivation, as if that's the problem. Those kids just aren't motivated. So even though somebody might be doing culturally responsive teaching in their mind, if that's the mental model they come with, that's deficit orientation. So just because you say it's culturally responsive, if you're coming with that belief that those kids are broken or they're unmotivated because of their zip code or whatever other background label you're identifying, then that's still very deficit oriented.
Yeah. So we want to think about how our instruction is meeting the way that kids learn and the way that kids have organized this information in their brains and really reaching them where they are. So how does culture affect the way that we learn?
Well, I'll go back to the point that I just made. Culture is the software to our brains, hardware. Most educators, particularly white educators, think of culture as, I'm talking about issues of race, racial politics, so that it gets conflated with anti-racism. So the reality is that is, again, very limited way of thinking about it. I think what happens too often is teachers don't think about the responsive part. So the responsive part is what DeFore talks about when he talks about kind of the three or four questions that guide PLC work. What do we want students to know and be able to do? What's the second question?
How will we know when they've learned it?
Thank you. How will you know? That's right. And the third is, what will we do if they don't learn it? And, the fourth, how do we extend for students who are ready for more? And a lot of times that third question, right, what will we do when the students don't learn it? gets overlooked. And I take it down to the instructional core to say, what will you do when the student is confused? So this is back to responsive, that dialogic with the teacher and the student, where the teacher's supporting the student to actually become not only metacognitive, but metastrategic. So the connection to culture is, if the teacher does not know the student's schema, the teacher cannot prompt the student to activate the problem-solving tools and strategies that she or he may have already taught the student. So we have, you know, kind of ignored instructional decision-making, that responsive part of culturally responsive, because we are so hyper-focused on always trying to talk about culture as if it's just for diverse students and I have to put something that's relevant in front of them. And we just diminish the power of what that particular pedagogical approach has in it that Dr. Latson-Billings was trying to lift up.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting point, because I also hear what I'm hearing, a piece of what you're saying is sometimes we're only thinking about teaching on like the macro level. And so we think about, okay, what does our unit look like? Like maybe an instructional coach will help teachers plan a unit, but then you're looking at individual responsiveness, like this individual student, you know, in this moment, I can respond to this student in this way. It's not only macro, but it's also like micro responsiveness.
Here's what I would add to that, or extend it, you know, maybe offer a shift, is it's not even looking at the lesson. It's looking at the instruction. Curriculum is one thing. Instruction is something different. Unfortunately, we have collapsed them. So teachers believe if they're covering their content or moving students through the lesson, that that's instruction. And we know it is not. So the idea of thinking about instruction is not just what's on the macro, right? That's where the curriculum is. The teacher has set that up, has kind of embedded the kind of engagement that's going to get students thinking in an extended way. But how the student actually has to process that information. So this is back to DeForest's question. When they get stuck, that may be whole class, that may be small group, that may be individual. But that teacher still has to know that, have that flexibility of being able to do that in any one of those settings. I see too many teachers still holding the whole class. So kids who are struggling, who may not, maximize their opportunity or their capacity to process information, hide in the whole group. So again, if the teacher doesn't have that opportunity to actually talk with the student and not just talk to them about their, you know, personal relationship, being friendly, but have a instructional conversation, talk to them about learning. What does it mean to be in a community of practice for students? And this is one of the things that I, again, talk about. And because that's not typically associated with culturally responsive teaching or pedagogy, again, we're so hyper-focused on what is culture versus how will I help the student actually build cognitive independence, right? Being able to leverage what they already know to extend that. And so that is what I think is the biggest, you know, addition to what I'd say. It's not just macro, micro. It's really helping the teacher understand the difference between how they are facilitator of the curriculum and how they then are a coach to the student's cognitive development during that instruction, which may happen with some whole class interaction. It may happen in small group. It may be happening one-on-one. I was a writing teacher when I was in the classroom. So part of what I always had to do was think about conferencing, or when students were doing peer editing, how was I helping them kind of get into their zone of proximal development so they were stretching themselves? Where's the cognitive stretch? And how are you actually supporting that? So what Vygotsky says is, when you're in your zone of proximal development, you need a more experienced learner to take you, a guide. It could be peer, it could be teacher, right? But so how is the teacher setting that up in the classroom? How is that happening? What are you saying and doing that not only give a one-word prompt, but also ask the student to tell you, how are they thinking about that? This is what Ron Ricard calls being metastrategic.
And to do this, we do need to know our student, not only, like you're saying, something maybe they could fill out in a questionnaire, but also how they think and how their brains work and what kinds of things we can do to engage them in different ways.
Engage the thinking. Yeah, and here's the problem with what I see a lot of teachers face is they don't invest in building the relationship into a level of trust with the student, so the student doesn't reveal that to them. And this is what I talk about in culturally responsive teaching the brain with the learning partnership. The first is rapport, building personal wealth, warmth, and connection. But the second is building an alliance. Me and you, student, up to something. And that student, I'm not doing it, you know, without telling the student. I'm not doing it to the student. I'm doing it with the student. I'm going to bring this kind of coaching just like a NBA coach would, but the player also knows you're bringing your skill. And together, we're working to help win the game, help make the team better, right? And so I do think there is a way in which teachers don't invest in the opportunity to talk with students about what does it mean to learn? What does it mean? Not just, here's a questionnaire, tell me about yourself. Or reveal your thinking to me. Well, if I don't believe you're helping me get better as a learner, why should I reveal anything to you? Mm-hmm. So particularly if you have microaggressions going on, student doesn't feel psychologically safe, or there are, you know, dominant narratives about who the student is. So now we are looking at microaggressions and stereotype threat. These are the pieces I think that Dr. Gloria Latson-Billings put together really, really well. That if you don't have a classroom that feels psychologically safe, there's intellectual safety to make mistakes, and not that those mistakes are not attributed to your linguistic background or your racial identity, your cultural orientation, then I won't continue to be vulnerable in front of you.
What are some things that a coach can do at a school level that would address some of that if that's what they're seeing in classrooms? Because as this other person coming into classrooms, you do see so much going on that the teacher is maybe not even aware of because it's maybe a subconscious sort of bias, or they've never really been called to have those kinds of conversations before, because in many places they have not.
And well, it depends.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it depends on what conversation that you want to have. My suggestion is you never start, depending on what your relationship is with the teacher, because, you know, as a coach, that's your first order of business, is to build your own partnership with the teacher and to help the teacher see what you see. So you can't just say, hey, you know, here's a thing you need to do because it looks like you have racial microaggressions going on. That really has to come from the students. And a lot of times it's funneled through the parents, which gets funneled to the front office. And that then could open up the conversation. So, you know, when I'm working with coaches, this is a conversation we have all the time, which is, where do we start with this? I see what's happening. Well, you have to find the right starting place, depending on the level of relationship you have with the teacher. And so you're always nurturing and building that. But you have to help the teacher see, because even if that teacher is open to having conversation with you, they're just taking your word for it, because that's not what they're saying. So one of the things I always do is I encourage teachers I'm working with and coaches that I'm training to work with teachers to always start with assessing the current reality. And I know this is something that Jim Nye talks about, Elena Aguilar talks about in their coaching models. And my focus of coaches is not to supplant those wonderful foundational coaching skills, but it's the what that they should be changing, that a lot of coaches don't have any, you know, background in, or don't know what should I say or do. So we start with assessing current reality. And that means just getting the teacher to see what you see. And a lot of times videotaping, get your iPhone out, audio tape, just so that you can have some kind of artifact, for lack of a better word, or if you want to use data, in a space that helps that conversation. So it's not just us talking, but it's actually looking at what's in the third space, that space that we can talk about this artifact. I love just simple audio recording. And then I ask the teacher, you know, send me that clip after you've listened to it. I'm going to create a transcript. There are a lot of good tools nowadays that will just, you know, run the audio or video and you get a whole transcript of the dialogue. And then I have the teacher read it and we read it together. And the opportunity for the teacher starts to see, oh, I'm talking a lot. Or, oh, the student's giving me one word answers. Or, I didn't realize that was the nature of that exchange. That opens a window for us to now have a conversation. Without that window, I cannot support the teacher to move to a new level. Yeah. Right. And so this is not always the skill set that our coaches have around what would you do, even if you bring that, you know, awareness, well, what do you do after that? Because a lot of times it just catches the teacher off guard and they just, I just need to stop doing that. Well, yeah, you do, but it depends on what it is. If you're talking too much, how do you shift that? If you're over scaffolding, how do you stop that? Because you can't stop over scaffolding until you increase student capacity, right? How do you do that? So it's the how do you do that, that when that teacher has the hunger for that, that the coach can partner with that teacher in a really powerful way.
Yeah, I think that's a great method to use. And we've talked a lot about video coaching, and the audio is great too, because so many people are nervous about video, and the audio can be a good way also to be respectful of students, because some students are not able to be recorded, things like that. So that's a really, I love that idea of just using audio. That's awesome.
Yeah. I have a couple of teachers that it's so funny because I just did a 4-week masterclass for instructional coaches and shared some of the audio and video. And one teacher, she was, for some reason, I don't know if she couldn't figure out how to work the audio on her phone, the voice memo, but she said, I'm just going to record it. And all we saw was the ceiling when we could hear them. I'm like, as long as we hear, we don't care that we're looking. We won't look. You know?
Yeah.
You're right. It's super easy. And what I try to tell coaches is really help teachers not focus on strategies or focus on themselves. Because a lot of times the focus is like, how am I teaching? The student should be the center. Our job is to coach students to become, you know, metacognitive of their own learning moves and then metastrategic about how to manipulate those. So our focus has to be on the student. So that audio is really about what is this, how do we get the student to say more than a one-word answer, right? What am I saying? So that the symbiotic dialogic part of that is really what we're focused on. Unfortunately, a lot of times teachers think it's just about me executing this strategy or me teaching this lesson. So a lot of the audio or video is really about that when it should be the student.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. Whenever we're looking at what's happening in classrooms, we're trying to collect data about what students do as a response to what the teacher is setting up. And so whenever if we're focusing only on what the teacher says, but then the kids are not producing any of the things that, you know, that they need to in order to demonstrate learning and to acquire new knowledge and new strategies of their own, then we're missing the point, really. I mean, the teacher can do all sorts of things, but if the kids aren't responding to it, then it's not working. We're not reaching.
Absolutely. And what that really means, right, if we unpack that statement you just made, that if I do the thing and the student's not learning it, that's on me. Mm-hmm. That I need to go back and say, what needs adjusting? Right. So just like a coach, right? Just like the personal trainer. If I'm a personal trainer and someone's come to me to get healthy and whatever the metrics are that we're tracking are not changing, I have to look at the program both in how am I putting the elements together, but also how am I motivating that person to carry them out? Because again, it's only that person who's going to do the exercising and they're only going to be at the gym for, you know, an hour. What about the other, you know, 6 days of the week, 24/7, right? So if they're not going to make those changes, if I can't motivate them to do a new thing, then that's on me and my coaching of them, my teaching of them. So this is the same with teachers. If the reality is, if the student is not learning it, this is DeFore's third question. It doesn't say, what do you want the student to do? It says, what will we do? Because whatever that process was ineffective. So we just need to tweak it. This is where inquiry is so wonderful, or running experiments or continuous improvement. But it's more than, you know, the plan, do, you know, act, study cycles, because you can do and you can study it, but what's your adjustment? And the adjustment has to be, what does a student say or do? Can I get the student to say or do a new thing, or stretch themselves, or take a new risk, or manage their emotions the closer to the learning episode when they're going into the learning fit? What is it that I want and need to change? And that to me is where the coach and the teacher have such a powerful connection. And when they're looking at it through the lens of, how do we disrupt the kind of inequity in our school that's just become kind of commonplace? Richard Elmore used to call it the unexamined wallpaper. It's there, and we just keep walking past it. Every year we see the same data, same kids at the bottom, same kids at the top, and we just shrug, kind of like, oh, that's just the way it is. But culturally responsive teaching really says, no, we get to interrupt that kind of cognitive redlining. When we really focus on helping the student become a more powerful learner. And that's very different from, oh, we just want to see how the student is thinking.
Mm-hmm. So then what are some of the key moves that teachers should be implementing in order to support students differently and to do this disruption, to actually change the way that we're working with kids?
Oh, that's a really great question. And I do think too often what we're sold are culturally responsive strategies. Right. So that question kind of falls into that. Tell me the thing to do. Well, first off, you, teacher, are the strategy. An instructional coach, you are coaching teachers to be better instructional decision making makers. So the first thing we do is we talk about, because I kind of crafted the Ready for Rigor frame, which is a slightly different approach to culturally responsive teaching. Different only in that its primary focus is instruction, and instruction that is centered around getting the student to be able to evolve and level up their learning. That is why it's actually called Ready for Rigor. How do we get kids ready to take on more of that cognitive load? So it's kind of broad in the ideas that I'll suggest here. This is actually why I run the masterclass, and I run a 6-month PLC program, because it is kind of more of a time, you know, a longer time to turn these things around. But immediately what you can do is, I call it preparing the dojo. How do you create the right environment that becomes a container for these things? The very first thing I think is most important, outside of getting to know your student, that's an ongoing thing, and we should be doing that beyond the first 4 weeks of school, right? Think about kind of, how are you using the second 6 weeks of school to get to know the student as a learner, and then to induct them into a, apprenticeship of learning, or a community of practice of learner. So anybody that knows my framework knows there's a quadrant that is actually called community of learners, right? There's a quadrant that's awareness. There's a quadrant that's focused on learning partnerships. And then there's a quadrant focused on information processing. So they are all kind of intersecting at all times, but the way that you start to enact those is create, you know, prepare the dojo, classroom, instructional course, the dojo. And you can do that by reframing mistakes, creating a culture of errors. And that typically can take, I'd say, depending on the grade level and what foundational pieces a teacher may have already put in place, that could take, 4 to 6 weeks, because most students are looking for the right answer, because, you know, there's a lot of compliance going on, and you have to actually break students of that habit. They've been socialized to be compliant. How many points is this? Is this going to be on the test? When you're trying to get them to be more reflective, but that means you've got to, use formative assessment in a powerful way. You've got to have feedback loops. You have to have time to talk to them. So one of the things that I get in time for them to talk to each other, I wrote an article called The Power of Protocols in Educational Leadership, ASCD's publication, April 2020, if anyone wants to look it up. So that's a very practical element you can put in. Start using protocols. Again, it's going to probably take you 2 to 4 weeks to get students to do it in a way that is students owning and understanding how to move through the process versus you having to be the conductor all the time and the prompter all the time. And that's critical, right? And then getting this culture of errors where you're reframing feedback as information, errors as information. That, I think, is the number one. Anything else, there, I can't give you a here, just do this, because it's not magic beans. And unfortunately, that's what happens. Oh, I'm doing these culturally responsive practices. But again, if you're doing them, but the student is not learning any better or not paying attention or learning to use those tools independent of your prompting, then what are you doing?
Yeah, I was looking at your, there was a document that I found on your site, and it was just some, you know, some of the five key culturally responsive teaching moves. And so then, yeah, you did refer to a few of those throughout our conversation today. The one about using ritual, recitation, repetition, and rhythm as content processing power tools. I think that, would you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think that goes into creating the environment. Again, those aren't strategies. Mm-hmm. Those are things that you actually start to integrate. So the idea of it, processing information, how are students knowing to go back to get it? So this is very much aligned with retrieval practice, right? So the recitation is students actually rehearsing and practicing saying out loud, but what they're not saying out loud is the content. What they're saying out loud is the learning move. Mm-hmm. Because again, teachers aren't talking to students about their learning moves, right? So one of the ways that I, you know, help teachers think about that is, so what do you tell the student when they're stuck, right? Or what they're doing, they've got an assignment and I'm confused and I'm calling the teacher over every 10 minutes, right? The way that you empower the student is like, here are three things I'm going to ask you to do. You're going to size it up, right? So look at the task, take time, and the teacher actually can structure this and slowly fade that scaffold in which they are actually having a few minutes, right? Underline, what is this asking you to do? Size it up, break it down. What are the first steps? What should you be doing? Then what are the tools I should be kind of pulling out of my head to actually get started, right? So that is the recitation. The students need to know that versus I'm just going to repeat the content in some call or response. That doesn't build any brain power.
Yeah, just discrete knowledge. It's not helping them learn how to think whenever they're approaching the situation.
Yeah, and I would use the words learn how to learn. Learn how to think. Thinking and learning aren't the same things. And there is a way in which we keep saying, oh, we want students to think. But if they haven't actually been able to develop their information processing skills, right? This is learning how to turn inert information to usable knowledge. They can't think. So we can't just say, oh, we want them to think, because then we do these thinking strategies and we have this, but no one's taught them how to turn this information into usable knowledge. This is the meaning-making part. So I think we overuse the word, so we want students to think. Yes, we all do, but then teach them how to learn that content and actually improve their information processing cycle. This is what the science of learning is teaching us. But there's a way in which I think coaches really have to help teachers elevate their own mental models or the way they talk about this, because this is what happens often. Teachers, I want my students to be able to think or to do, you know, the higher on Bloom's or deeper on Webb's. It's like, yeah, we do want that depth of knowledge, you know, will to be a little higher. But the fact is, you have to build their skill set in order to do that processing. And that's not a, here's a strategy, here's a sentence frame. And unfortunately, too many of those things turn into crutches because we don't phase them out. We're over scaffolding. So this is the counter, right? Culturally responsive teaching is designed to build the student's capacity so the teacher does not have to over scaffold. Build the student's capacity so they know how to take inert information and turn it into usable knowledge without a lot of prompting from the teacher. And if the teacher doesn't find the students are motivated, then the idea is to look at how are we not leveraging the brain's dopamine systems, right? Dopamine is that brain chemical that we get rewarded with because the brain thinks it's the yummiest thing. Once we do hard stuff or we do interesting, complex stuff. And kids are doing this all the time at home. So why are they so disengaged in your classroom, right? And this is where coaches can bring the science of learning, not like, oh, let's read research, but let's actually talk about the brain rules we need to have in place. Let's actually talk about what does that mean when you have someone coming from a collectivist culture and how their schema has been developed. Too often what I see is that when people are talking about culturally responsive teaching, they just think that's more group work. So when I think, oh, collectivist culture, then we just do collectivist things. So that's just more group work. That's not building an individual's capacity to carry more of the cognitive load. That's called group work. And the kids who are struggling can hide in the group. So it's actually counterproductive, but satisfies the teacher who thinks, oh, I'm doing this thing, so I'm culturally responsive. It is not about you. It's about the student.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are such great points. And thank you for sharing all of this information with us. I know that coaches are going to walk away maybe with another lens to look at their school with. And then I know they're going to want to learn more from you. So how can people keep learning more from you if they would like to do that?
Yeah, they should first get on my newsletter. They can go to my website, crtinthebrain.com. And there's a place where they can opt in. And usually once I send my newsletter out, they are going to know about upcoming opportunities. I did a series of masterclasses last fall for leaders, coaches, and teachers. And then in the spring, I do one that's 4 weeks, 2 hours every week for coaches. So we'll have another one coming up in August, right before school, that'll run 4 weeks before school and set coaches up to really think about developing these skills. And they can also, you know, read Culturally Responsive Teaching of the Brain. I'm working on a new book, and that should come out late fall. So again, getting on that newsletter is the best way to be in touch with what's going on, and connecting with me on LinkedIn. That's always a good way as well, because it's a place that I share and, you know, what's going on a little bit, but it's more just about building our network. And I'd love to be connected with more of the coaches, because again, it takes a village, and this is, you know, heavy lifting, and we all have to kind of be there for each other.
Yes. Yes. I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Okay. I know I don't use the phrase drinking from a fire hose very often, but that was a lot of good stuff. And I know that you're walking away with new ideas, things you want to think about, things you want to learn about. Please go check out the website. There's some great stuff there. And I think that newsletter is a really good way to be notified about new stuff and to learn a little bit more every week about what culturally responsive teaching looks like and how you can support it at your campus. Remember, I've got that Making the Shift webinar for you. You can check that out at buzzingwithmissb.com/shift, and that will help you in supporting teachers and embracing new learning and new ways of thinking. And I want to remind you that next week we're going to continue our mini-series on better instruction with an episode about the science of reading. So you're going to get a quick overview of Scarborough's reading rope in this episode, and you're going to learn what this instruction looks like in the classroom. And that's happening next week. Until then, happy coaching. Now that you've got so much to think about, head over to buzzingwithmissb.com to grab some free downloads, become a VIB, and check out the podcast show notes. Happy coaching!